Okay.
Okay, we're going to try something. I don't know how it's going to work, but we're going to try something. And normally what I like to do is, you know, to focus on one thing and not on everything. But today I want to focus on everything. I'm going to explain why and what we're doing and why we're going to try to do it. Let's go backwards. There are, in this week's Parashat Vayera, it deals with what's called Perek Yutet, chapter 18, Perek Yutet, 19, Perek Kaf, Kaf Aleph, and Kaf Bet. Those are your first five sources. So going backwards, the last and arguably the most exciting part of the Parashat, maybe one of the most exciting episodes of the entire Torah, not just exciting, also tragic, also disturbing, something which is really spiritually grotesque, is known as Akedat Yitzchak. And when God calls upon Avram to take his son and to offer him as an offering, I really want to focus on three words, and then we're going to try to see how much we can work other things into it. So in source number five, the first three words are V'yichi achar dvir me'ela, or four words actually, V'yichi achar dvir me'ela, and after these things transpired. So what's the first thing that you ask yourself when you read word, when you read something like that? Very obviously, what's the first thing that you ask? Which things? Which things are we talking about? Which means, is this story an independent episode? Is this disconnected from anything else that happened? Or is the Akedah in some, you know, way, shape, or form colored by, caused by, connected to something which took place prior to this? So therefore, in a sense, really what I'm asking is, well, you can ask it in different ways. Is there anything which can possibly justify such an episode? I do want to continue. The next two words, or three or four words, V'Elokim nisa et Avraham. And God tested Avraham. So, and after these things, God tested Avraham. So is the test, which is going to take place, somehow connected to anything prior to this? So when you ask, so, as I said, the first thing then becomes, okay, which episode before? Is it the thing which is immediately before this, or something a little bit before that, a little bit more before that, something further? And obviously, we could, you know, go very, very far back to try to figure it out. Now, that, as I said, is my ultimate goal, is to come back to this point. But along the way, I do want to make some other observations within the parsha. Now, there's always multiple approaches that one can have when one reads things like this. Sometimes commentaries, especially commentaries, get stuck on micro points, on nuances, on words, on little phrases. And sometimes, and it's actually rarer, that you find the commentaries dealing with larger issues, broader issues, macro issues taking place. What we're going to deal with is we're going to look at micro points, but we're going to try to deal with macro issues. So which really concerns us is the larger points today. But I think that there's something which is intriguing in terms of the interrelationship between the various chapters within the parasha itself. Which means more so than most, I think that there's overlap and that there are things which are interrelated, and that's what we're going to try to look at. What ultimately is going to be the significance of that, so therefore, ultimately, you will all have Dvar Torahs to say for Shabbat, although I recognize that each one of you can end up with a different Dvar Torah, because ultimately, what your own personal conclusion is going to be based upon the data that we see will be your conclusion. And, part of what's interesting is that you can have very, very, very different ones. It can get into political discussions. It can take different sides of certain political issues. But again, I don't want to get ahead of myself. All that we're going to see as we proceed. One thing which we notice, or hopefully we notice, because this is something which has been pointed out by commentaries, but it's sometimes the most frustrating type of question. I had studied with Rabbi Soloveitchik for 3 years, and he would sometimes ask something like this, and everyone would look at him like, what are you talking about? He would say, okay, what should come next? What do you mean what should come next? It's like, you know, we spend our energy figuring out what it says, not what it should say. So that's the kind of question, which is a very good question. I said it's disturbing because it makes you think. So, but the example I'm going to use over here is an example that the commentaries do note. And that is that after God tests Abraham, or after we're informed that it's a test, what does it say? Vayomer Elav, and God says to him, Avraham, Vayomer Hineni, he goes, here I am. Vayomer, he says, Kachna bincha yichidcha asher ahavta, take your son, the only son that you love, et Yitzchak, Yitzchak, v'lech lecha l'eretz ha-Moriah, go to the land of Moriah, v'leu shem la'ola, and uplift him there as an ola, alachad arim asher omar alecha, to one of the mountains that I'm going to tell you. What's Avram's response? V'yashkem Avram baboker, Avram gets up early in the morning, v'yachvoshet chamoro, he mounts his donkey, v'yikachet shnei ne'aravito, he takes his two young men with him, v'yitzak b'no, and his son Yitzak, v'yivaka etzei ola, he takes wood for the burnt offering, v'yakam, he gets up, v'yilech el makom asher amar Elokim, he goes to the place that God had said. V'yom ha'shlishi, on the third day, he lifts his eyes. He sees the place from afar. Any of you notice any questions that came up so far in terms of what's not here? As I said, that's the more frustrating question. So what's not here?
He doesn't respond.
Correct. But explain more. He doesn't respond. How do you want him to respond?
Meaning like Shem's talking to him.
Okay.
Telling him to do something.
So what response do you...
He should say, why? Everything.
Okay, let me answer. Okay. Should he say why, or you would want to say why?
I will say why.
Okay,
no,
but we have to be more careful.
Yeah.
We have to be more careful with that. And by the way, that is one of the biggest challenges of trying to learn things properly. Are we reading our own... And by the way, I accept the statements as valid, but after they're made, I have to then ask, okay, is this really something which Abba would ask? But what is missing over here? Along the same lines, what is missing? Am I making you think? Is that a bad thing? You want me to just... you just want my candy? I should just tell you everything?
He doesn't say the place.
Okay, that actually doesn't seem like such a strong point. That's a phenomenal point. He never actually says the place. He never tells him where to go precisely.
Uh-huh.
What he does say is, bring him to the place, Asher Omar Elefa, which I will tell you. We never hear any more correspondence regarding where the place is. Which then leads up to, what are we told he said? That on the third day he sees the place from afar. So on the third day, does he have a revelation? How does he see it? I mean, is there a sign, like a flashing neon sign saying, here's the place to kill him? Or is this his own, is he getting carried away? And I'm sorry for bringing that up. Is Avram getting carried away? Or did God tell him the place and just the Torah doesn't give us every single piece of information? But from looking at the text, he says, I will tell you, and we never hear that that further follow-up conversation. It's not all that different. I mentioned that last week. It's not all that different. Then Lech Lecha, he says the place that I... Actually, there he says that I'll show you. Over here it says I'll show you, then he can say that he sees the place. But he says the place that I'm going to tell you. So then there one would assume that there should be a further correspondence. In fact, if I lived a Simon Says type of life, right, which presumably that's what Judaism is, when God tells you, then you do something, doesn't it? I would say that he should be in a holding pattern until he gets more information. God says, go to the place I tell you, and didn't tell him.
Isn't this that famous theme that Auerbach and Mises talks about? The text doesn't fill in the details, and that's exactly the point of that whole discussion of realism, biblical realism versus Greek and Western realism, and that, what you were talking about a moment ago, the big issue and the little points. I mean, the big issue we're going to get, but the points are not.
It's 100% valid. The problem over here is that because information is missing, that opens the door for every single commentary now to read our own agendas into the text and say what it does say, what it doesn't say, what it does do, what it doesn't do. I can assure you there are commentators, biblical commentators, religious, rabbis, whatever, so on, who have said that Avram was wrong by proceeding. Because God never said the next point is where it was. And he was too exuberant.
He's rushing.
Yeah, rushing, got carried away, and he should have waited for more information. And that's where the angel comes and stops. What are you doing? I mean, I just want to see you get in the car. I mean, I didn't tell you to go through with it. Why are you picking a knife up on the kid? What do you mean you saw the... What do you mean you saw the place from afar? kind of an Auerbach, but Bob Dylan has a great...
never mind
Auerbach. He has a line something like, and God said to Abraham, kill me a son. And Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. Which goes back to the point, what doesn't take place here? What doesn't take place here? No, there's no response. There's no response. But why is that a good point that there's no response? Why is that a fair point? Why is that a valid point that there's no response?
He's the ultimate, he
so is it a good point that there's no response or a bad point?
I mean, it is a good point. It's funny because, how does he know where to go and what to do and why he's different? The mushroom is whatever.
Right. So let me phrase that a little differently. Should we expect that Abraham or Avraham would have responded in some way to God's calling upon him to kill his son? Should there have been a response?
Yeah. He interceded for stone.
Good.
And the ostracized Ishmaelite who failed to address it.
Okay, good on both points, but yes and no. Let's look at Ishmael first.
Or since he was distressed, at least.
Yes, that's the right word. That's the right word. We have two instances in this parsha. I mean, that's really what I was getting at by looking at these other pieces of information. We have two instances where God shares with him some kind of information or some kind of situation is taking place. One of them which deals with a question of morality and decency, and the other one dealing with a son who something bad is going to happen to. So you realize that either of these are going to be a good place to look to see, okay, what kind of response does he have? So and the responses are different in the two places. If we'll start with Sodom, that's back in our first source on the first page. In verse 23, Pasukah Gimel, Vayigash Avraham Vayomar, and Avraham comes to God and he says, Ha'af tispeth tzadikim rasha, are you going to kill a righteous person together with a wicked person? Now that is, as I said, a very strong, he's not questioning God, it's more than that. He's calling God to task by not playing by his own rules. In the next couple of verses, Kaf Dalet, Ulayish Hamishin Tzadikim Betocha Ir, maybe there are 50 righteous people. Ha'af Tispeh, are they going to be killed as well? Belotisa, they're not going to be saved. Lemakom, Leman Hamishin Tzadikim Hashem Bekirba, you're not going to save the place for the 50 righteous people. And now he goes further. Here's where he really, again, as I said, he calls God to task in verse 25. Kaf Hey, Chalila Lecha Me'asot Kadavar Hazeh, Lahamit Tzadikim Rasha, Vayakit Tzadik Rasha. How can you go and behave in such a way to treat the righteous like the wicked? Right? Chalila lach hashofet kol ha'aretz le'yaseh mishpat. How can the judge of the whole earth act in such an unjust way? Which means it's not just that Avraham decides to intercede for the sake of Sodom. It's much more than that. It's the type of intercession that takes place. It's this declaration, it's the moral declaration, which means what he's really saying to him is, how can you, God, act immorally? And what's immorally, as far as Avraham's concerned? A lack of justice. What does justice mean? Justice means that a righteous person is not going to die the death of a wicked person. Now, if I take that, as a macro conversation dealing with entire city, where he's saying, sometimes you have to wipe out a city, an earthquake's going to come, an earthquake's not going to only hit one person, not the other person, it's going to come to the city. But he's challenging him on that and saying, you can't bring an earthquake to a city where it has so many righteous people. He's saying, God, you can't act like that. And by the way, all of you can say, who said God can't act like that? God can do whatever he wants to do. But Avram's calling him on it, goes, that's not justice. Over here, if I extrapolate from that argument, I can then say, take my son that I love, take him and offer him and kill him? How is that justice? Which means Avraham, the
person who protests acts of injustice should be protesting on a moral level to this act of injustice. Is that a fair point, a fair way of saying it? So I'm saying that's one thing. That's one whole approach he could have taken this, in terms of the side of justice. What's the other way that he could have taken it? And that's when we compare it to his response in terms of Ishmael. In source number 4, which is Parakaf Aleph, verse, we'll start with Pasuk Tet. Vatera Sarah et ben Hagar ha-Mitzrit she'yalda la'Avraham mitzachek. She sees that he is being mitzachek. Now, first of all, let's pause there for a second. The fact that Yishmael is being mitzachek, what does mitzachek mean? He's laughing. Is that good or bad? Everything
it's
about
you. Bad.
What? Why does it seem bad? Okay, is he the first one to laugh in terms of the birth of Yitzchak? Everybody laughs about it. Avram hears that he's going to have a child, he laughs. Sarah hears she's going to have a child, she laughs. Right? The child is born. What do they name him? Yitzchak, which means laughter is all about it. If I'm not mistaken, I saw many years ago, Philo said that the sacrifice of Isaac would have been the sacrifice of laughter from the world. Getting rid, like Akedah Yitzchak would have been getting rid of laughter from the world. So I mean, could be he overstates this a little bit, but it's this idea of Yitzchak being so bound up with laughter. On the other hand, Yitzchak doesn't seem to be a very jovial fellow, which is why the name itself seems to be somewhat of a mismatch. Although we should note that the name Yitzchak is future oriented. Yitzchak is the future. Yeah, it's a future perspective and not necessarily a present perspective. And that, by the way, is a very important aspect of Yitzchak's existence. So the fact that Ishmael is laughing as well, so meaning, why is this even a surprise? Which means it's only based upon the response that we have, the response of Sarah, that we realize something's going on. Vatomer la'avram garasha amahazot ve'et bana ki lo yirash ben amahazot im b'ni im Yitzchak. You know, chase him away, get rid of him, because he's not going to be he's not the real progeny, he's not going to be the one who's going to inherit with my son, with Yitzchak. Vayira davar ma'od b'nei Avram. What does that mean? Vayira davar ma'od b'nei Avram. This is an emotion. It doesn't tell us what he says, but it's an emotion. What's his emotion? He is very, very disturbed by this. He's very disturbed by this. Now, would that be unfair if by the next chapter, by the Akedah, God says, take your son, your only son that you... By the way, I'm not convinced that it should say, take your son, your only son, the son that you love. I think maybe you can read it. Take your son, the only son that you love. Maybe there's more love over you, and that's exactly what the point is. Take the son, the only son that you love, Yitzchak, and offer him up as an offering. I mean, shouldn't there at some level be, if not the moral response, you know, how can the judge of the whole earth ask me to do something which is so... essentially immoral, why can't I have a response in terms of at least the way that Avram feels, which the Torah shares with us regarding the chasing away of Ishmael, and say that Avram was very disturbed by this, Avram was very upset by this. Who realizes that Avram is upset? God, in the very next verse. Don't be upset. Go ahead and do what Sarah wants you to do. Kol asher tomari lecha Sarah shma b'kolecha. Everything that Sarah says, you should listen. Last week I was by my butcher with my wife. We were shopping. And he says, everything that Sarah says, you should listen. She listened to your wife. So I said, that's why I didn't marry someone named Sarah. I listened to her anyway. Ki b'Yitzchak yikred Zerah. Because Yitzchak is the one who's going to be your real progeny. But here you have Avraham's feelings. He doesn't articulate it, and God responds to his feelings. By the way, you do have to appreciate there's something very tender about that. Very right? That God responds to how Avraham feels, not even that he says, that how he feels, and he talks to him about how he feels. So over here, what about... Which means, you know, everything that you can claim is missing from the next chapter, from chapter 22, Perikov Bet. I mean, it is over here. So even the feelings that he's doing, you know, that's one of the great mysteries, how Avram feels. There were all kinds of things. I don't know how much literature has been written about this, ranging from somebody named Spiegel called The Tenth Trial to Kierkegaard, and on and on and on and on. People have dealt with the philosophical, the theological, the emotional, the personal aspects of what took place over here, and anything which is missing, so then obviously you can fill it in. But this parallel between Avraham's response or lack of response by Yitzchak versus his response by Yishmael is something which, you know, at least we have to note. What would be the answer if we had to give a quick answer? How would you respond to it?
This is his own desire.
That apparently when it says, and after these things, God tested Avraham, that Avraham must be aware that there's a test. If he's not aware that there is a test, if he's aware that there's a test, then we can understand why he acts perhaps the way that he does, because he knows that he must sense that there's some kind of a test. So then now the rules are somewhat different. It says God tested him. So he knows that God is testing him now. So now, as I said, now the rules may be a little bit different. I did have a couple of more thoughts about this. I'm going to come back to a moment to the comparison that we've started, but I did have a couple of more thoughts about this. One is, at the very end of last week, we also have a situation which is far more connected than you would have thought. And when I say it's more connected in terms of liturgy, it's connected to the Akedah. And what's that? And that's circumcision. If you read the liturgy, the things which are said, the blessings which are said by a circumcision, by a Brit Milah, you'll see that the idea of offering your son is mentioned in context to the Brit Milah. But the reason I'm saying that there's a parallel is here Avram is being told to take a knife to his son, to his young son, to draw blood. And by the way, in a certain sense then, that every parent subsequently through history who has performed a circumcision on their son is, in a certain sense, it's seen like Avraham, like this, you know, as Kierkegaard called him, this knight of faith marching off and willing to listen to his God, perhaps against his... or her better judgment, and saying, how can I, you know, do something which is so cruel and so on to my child? So if we broaden the canvas a little bit, and we start at the end of last week instead of the beginning of this week, then you have this direct parallel. And I would even state it like that. At the moment that Avram takes a knife to his son, to Yitzchak, he probably would have thought, okay, this is it. This is as bad as it gets. I mean, you know, he never imagined that he would actually be asked to do this again. And this time, you know, complete the job, not just draw a little bit of blood, but actually do something which is far more disturbing. So I'm just again pointing out that there may be a parallel over here. There is another parallel which would be suggested. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but I also have a sense that this may have been in the back of Avram's mind. Let's consider for a second. Why is the Akedah, the binding of Yitzchak, and by the way, the word Akedah does not appear over here at all in terms of God's command. It's not. It's only there in Avram's response again, which leads me, what does the word Akedah mean? Do we know what it means?
Bind.
To bind, to tie him down. God never said to tie him down. It says Avram does this. So again, is Avram getting a little more carried away than God asked him to do, than what God had asked or not? So I mention that as well. What is the most difficult aspect, or maybe that's unfair to put it, what are the various aspects in terms of the Akedah, why Avram would not want to do this? The first is the easiest, and that is obviously in terms of a parent. A parent would not want to do this to a child. How could a parent possibly, you know, go and act in such a horrific way to a child? A parent to be asked to kill a child is something which is, you know, as disturbing as it can ever be. What other levels are there? Or is that the only level? Is there more to it, or is that the entire analysis?
He preached against it, no.
Excuse me?
Did he preach against that? Like,
is that, okay, it would be a little different, sense. Right? Because Avram's entire life has been anti-polytheism. He's, right, we discussed last week the breaking of the idols and so on, and against human sacrifice, against a God who needs things. The way the polytheistic gods work is you basically bribe them all. And they would go for the bribes. You'd give them something that they needed, and then your life would be, they say in Hebrew today, dvash. I call it dvash. Everything would be good. So Avram's been preaching against this, which means if he has to carry through with this, then it's not just Yitzhak who dies, it's Avram's entire worldview, which gets sacrificed at the same time. But there's another thing that I said that keeps on appearing in the back of my mind, and that is if we do follow through the Midrashim from last week, which I do believe have far more of a place in the text itself, and that is regarding Avraham and the furnace. Which means when Avram's thrown into the furnace, who's the one who throws him to this furnace? Well, basically, it's his father. His father is the one who gives him over to Nimrod, and they throw him into the furnace. Which means, and what happens to Avraham? He escapes unscathed. And as I said, how's that connected to the text? Is when God says to him, "Hi, I'm God. I'm the one who took you out of Ur Kasdim." If you look at the Targum Onkelos, the word Ur means furnace. It means fire. I'm the one who took you out of the furnace in Kasdim. Which means, yes, there's a whole Midrash which embellishes it, but there are those who will claim that that phrase is in the text of the Torah itself. And that's why God says, I'm the one who saved you from the fiery furnace. So, if Avraham was saved from the furnace, so would it be a huge leap of faith for him to believe that Yitzchak would be saved as well? Is that a terrible question? Okay, God says to go and do this. My father did this to me. I'm going to do this to him. And it's going to have a happy ending. I don't know how it's going to have a happy ending, but it's going to have a happy ending. So again, Avraham's history may be important, but what I'm coming back to, everything I'm saying now is based upon that one phrase, that God tested him, and that he somehow feels that there's a test, and maybe he feels that, you know, according to tradition, Avram went through 10 tests. So maybe he feels Yitzchak also has to go through, you know.
He's going through the test, or only later he understands that he had like 10 tests. I'm not sure every test he knows, okay, now I'm starting a test, now it's.
Right, but over here when it says, and God tested Abraham, from his lack of response, from him not saying, how could the judge of the whole earth not act in a moral sense? From his not, we don't hear his emotion. Again, the lack of those response, and the positive saying, and God tested Abraham, and by the way, this is the only time it says it. Yeah, there are other tests, by the way, there's not complete agreement what the tests are, but this is the only time that it actually says, and God tested Abraham. So does he feel that there's a test? So I'm suggesting maybe he senses that there's a test going on.
He could sense there is a test, but nobody promises that the test is, okay, I'm going to save Yitzchak after that.
Right.
Maybe the test is, you lose your son, and how you respond to you.
Right. Which that leads us to another one of the problems which the Midrashim actually articulate, and that is, on the one hand, God said that Yitzchak is going to be your progeny, your the one who's going to inherit you. On the other hand, he says, take Yitzchak and put him up as an offering. So here is, at face value, an impossible contradiction. So how is he supposed to believe in a God who contradicts himself? Which, as I said, that's the level the Midrash brings into it, because we have God telling contradictory things. Although I will note, God, and you can look at it as many times as you want to, but it never says to kill him. It never said that God said to kill him. The word to kill him never appears. If you want, I'll come back to that, because that's actually very intriguing, because he never said to kill him.
See, if a scientist wants to have an experiment, you know, if this will be, if such and such will happen, he has to say ahead of time, if out of 20 cases it happens, then I'll know. You can't just say, I'm just going to keep going until I know, because at a certain point you have to say what the terms of the experiment are before you can have an experiment. Do you know what I'm saying? So in order for it to be a test, there has to be
parameters,
some kind of language,
yeah.
To trappings of a test. Right?
Yeah.
And so he has to make them up as if that first test that when he was thrown into the furnace is the basis for which he knows the test.
As I said, this is an intuition on my part. It's not it's not something that I can prove one way or the other. I'm totally intuiting this, that if Avraham feels that he went through this and was saved, so then certainly Yitzchak will be saved, because it's more than that. Because by him, there was no covenant yet. There was no way that God said that this will be a major... Over here, there's a covenant, which means I have a contradiction. But by the way, I'm going to say something which Jews, certainly rabbis, can never say. absolutely never say it. There is a very simple resolution, which, and this I have written about, and try to show all the sources. It's very disturbing. Jews get bothered by this. There is another very simple solution, and I'll give you a hint, and then you'll get it 100%, which every Christian will get when they read it. And what's that? Why do Christians get it? Because they read the whole text through the perspective of Christianity. So what would the perspective of Christianity be?
Just like sacrificing Jesus.
It would be the crucifixion and then the
resurrection.
One second. Do you all realize how... And by the way, I even found one midrash that said that it says that Yitzchak carries the wood. And the word that it uses for wood is the word that it uses as tzlav. Yitzchak carried the tzlav on the way, just like Jesus... By the way, don't get so excited about this. The whole New Testament is based upon Tanakh. So therefore, they deliberately wanted to make the crucifixion scene look like Akedat Yitzchak. It's not the other way around. It's not like we copied them and Dreshim copied the other side. It's that they're basically saying, well, God would not, you know, God would not ask Avram to do something that he wouldn't be willing to do himself, as it were. Meaning that God would not ask Avram to sacrifice his own son unless he was willing to sacrifice his own son, which means once you think in this direction, by the way, does this bother you that I'm saying all this? You're allowed to say it bothers you. He said only Jews get bothered by this. Christians will love this. That there's a very simple resolution. God says, on the one hand, that Yitzchak Yikra Zerach, Yitzchak is going to be the one who's going to continue the line. On the other hand, God says, take him and offer him as an offering. So what's the resolution? Take him, kill him, make an offering, and then resurrection. Okay? But as I said, rabbis can never say this because they never want to walk up that, you know, theological path, even though it is far more pronounced in Jewish sources than you would ever imagine.
Yeah, isn't
there this idea of the angels crying? Yeah, but it's even more than that. It's much more than that. For example, the first three brachot in the Amidah, right? The first one is based on Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Magen Abraham, what's the bracha for Yitzchak? Chaye Meitim is connected to Yitzchak. The Haftorah that we're going to read this week, the theme of the Haftorah is resurrection. It's Tchiyat HaMeitim, which means there is a whole strand within Jewish thought which sees this. And see, one of the ways of looking at it is that once Avram was prepared intellectually to go down this path, so then God considers it as if he offered him, which means that the offering of Yitzchak never was meant, I'm going to maybe say this when we end, but the offering of Yitzchak was never meant to be within the physical world. It was meant to be in the emotional world. Which means, is Avram willing to serve God to the extent that he's willing to let go of everything that he has and give it to God? Once he's willing to do it emotionally, it's already done. It doesn't have to be in the real world. I mean, that's the whole state of an emotional world. So therefore, once he's willing to sacrifice him, he sacrificed. Once he's willing to offer him, so Avram succeeded. There's nothing more to do at that point. And therefore God says, that's it. I mean, it's over. You've done it. You've passed the test. You know what? We'll do this out of sequence, but I'll show you something which maybe you'll find interesting. In the Gemara, and I can assure you there's another half a dozen sources that say this. Look at source number 6. This is a Gemara in Ta'anit. Amr Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amr Rav Yonatan. So that's the source of the teaching. Back to Rav Yonatan. Shlosha shalu shelo kahogin. There were three who made requests that were not done properly. Improper request. L'shnayim hishivu kahogin, l'achad hishivu shelo kahogin. Two of them God responded in a proper way, and one in an improper way. And what are these three instances? The Eluhain, Eliezer Eved Avram, v'shol ben Kish, v'yiftach hagiladi. Skipping a bit. What's the story of Yiftach? Whatever walks out of my house, I'll give you as an offering when I come back. Yiftach also from the word petach, from the house. Also Yiftach, that he should have canceled the vow. How do you cancel a vow? You find a petach in the vow. So all this is connected to the name Yiftach. Yiftach agil adi, dechtiv, vaya yotzei asher yotzei midelti beiti, whoever leaves the door of my house, yochol afilu devar tameh, could have, the thing that worked out could have been something which wasn't kosher. Yeshiva shloka hogan, God didn't answer him properly, nizdemalo bito, and his daughter came out. By the way, even though you're totally convinced of it, it never says in the text in the Navi that he killed his daughter either. If you read the text in the Navi, it doesn't say that. But in our imagination, we imagine that he did kill her. V'hainu d'ka'amar lo Navi Yisrael, and that's what the prophet says, atzarein b'galadim rofein sham, v'chtiv asher lo tzeveti, v'lo dibarti, v'lo alta'a libi. And that's what it refers to when the prophet says, which I did not command, I didn't say, and it never crossed my mind. Now, this citation is a citation from the book of Yirmiyahu, from the 19th chapter. Yirmiyahu over here is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And he says, why is Jerusalem destroyed? He says, it's destroyed because of the horrific behavior that the Jews had. What was the horrific behavior? So the particular sin that it talks about over here is what's called a place called Gehinom. Do you know what Gehinom is?
Where?
You know what it is, Gehinom? Where it is, what it is?
It's in the Quran. Like, I know where it is, but I don't know what it means.
Okay, fine. I'll tell you a story. You like stories? Good. Mm-hmm. The story took place 90 years ago, more or less. The chief rabbi in Israel, which didn't exist yet at the time, was Rav Kook. Rav Kook was a very contentious individual. When I say contentious, it's very ironic, because he was a man himself who was very full of love and tried to make peace with all kinds of people, and therefore everybody was upset with him. Everyone was upset with him. The secular were upset with him because he wasn't radical enough. The ultra-Orthodox upset him because he dealt with the secular. The Mizrahi, the religious Zionists, were upset with him because he was too religious for them. Everybody was upset with him. When I say he's too religious, I really mean that. They asked him a question in terms of women having a right to vote. Right? He goes, what's your right? And he said, absolutely not. Women should not vote. Women, forget about being elected, women shouldn't vote. And they if we lose half of our votes, we're going to have no political power. I mean, what do you mean? Just on a purely pragmatic level. He goes, no, against Jewish law, whatever, which is totally imaginary. In terms of being against Jewish law. All of his arguments are very, very weak. I'm sorry for saying that. You want me to back that up? I'll direct you to sources on that. It was all coming from a philosophical, much more than from a real legal position. Anyway, as I said, Rav Kook, in a sense, was tragic because he loved everybody, and everybody was mad at him. So it's hard to lead one's life like this. But philosophically, he was incredibly daring. Nobody knew, by the way, how daring he was, because he himself didn't publish most of his writings. Even at that time, he trusted a couple of students. One was a son, one was the Nazir. A couple of others did minor things. And he wrote his own, what do you call it? He had diaries. He had spiritual diaries. And that's basically the writing that he had, spiritual diaries. And they would publish his spiritual diaries. But to do this, there was a lot of cutting and pasting going on. And they protected him, because if he said things that were too radical, which people do in spiritual diaries, then he would get into a lot of trouble. Today, we have access to the originals. At that point, they didn't. Anyway, when he published one, he was accused of being a heretic and so on, and there was a big, big fight going on, and one of the greatest rabbis in Europe came to visit Israel. He was the Gera Rebbe. So the Gera Rebbe came to Israel, and both sides called upon him to try to side with them and to declare, you know, the other side to be wrong. So they asked. So they agreed to ask him to adjudicate between Rav Kook and between the Ada, the ultra-Orthodox. So within this visit, Rav Kook once came and called on the Rebbe, and the Rebbe once came and called on Rav Kook, and they went together, and they walked together from, you know where Rav Kook lived? He lived Rehov Rav Kook. That's why it's called Rehov Rav Kook. So if you know where it is, it's really in the center of Jerusalem. So they walked, it's right off of Yafo, right on the corner of Yafo. So they walked to Yafo, and they walked up to go into the old city. Right, this is long before, right? This is the night. So they're walking to the old city, and as they're walking, the Ger Rebbe says to Rav Kook, Rabbi, your Jerusalem is not like the Jerusalem of the time of the prophets. Now, I don't know how bad it must have been. I guess he went to Kikar Tzion. Who knows what was going on at night? But how bad was Kikar Tzion, you know, whatever it was, 90 years ago? Like what was going on? I mean, of course, I mean, the obvious thing to do is to blame the women, how they were dressing, or to blame whatever else. So how bad was it? But he said, this is, I understand where he's coming from. This is the perspective of somebody who lived in the diaspora, comes to Israel. Israel's a book of theory. It's a place of theory. It's a place of dreams. And then you see the reality, and the reality doesn't always match what your imagination is. So he comes and he says, no, your Jerusalem is not the Jerusalem that I had, the Jerusalem of the prophets, the Jerusalem that I know from the prophets. So Rav Kook didn't answer. So they go to the old city. They pray by the Kotel, and they come out and they walk out the other way. Now this gets to, if you come out towards walking towards the Cinematheque, if you know what I mean, to come out the other way, and they came out walking the road, and he points and he says, "Do you know what this place is?" So he says, "No, but it's very beautiful. There's a big valley and a hill, whatever." So he says, "This place, in the time of the prophets, this place was called Gei Ben Hinnom. This was the place they used to do child sacrifice." He goes, "But Jerusalem today is not like Jerusalem in the time of the prophets." So that was the response. Now, that's very interesting, because you can imagine what it was like when Yirmiyahu was walking around. Well, guess what? Read chapter 19 of Yirmiyahu, and he says, the reason I'm going to destroy this place is because these people are serving God or gods in a way that, again, what are the exact words which are being quoted over here? In a way, it says, Asher lo tziviti, which I didn't command, velo dibarti, and I never said, velo alta alibi, and it never crossed my mind that people should be doing this. So the context in Yirmiyahu is child and human sacrifice. Okay, before I come back to the Gemara, the way the story then ended is that when the Gera Rebbe, both sides asked him for an adjudication, so he didn't give any, but he said he'll send back a message. So on the boat, after he left, he wrote a letter, and in the letter he said that the only sin he found himself guilty of was that he loves Jewish people too much Ahavat Yisrael, which, by the way, both sides decided that they were right because of what he said. But you know, if we're going to be guilty of sins, you know, that would be a good sin that we should all be guilty of, is loving the Jewish people too much. Continuing the Gemara, Asher lo tziviti zebno shemisha melech Moab shenema vikach beno b'chor sheim loch tachta ve'aleo ola. So it talks about somebody who offered their son as an offering. Velo dibarti, that I never said, zayiftach. We have to go and apparently sacrificing his daughter. Velo olta alibi, it never crossed my mind or never came in my heart. Zayitzchak ben Avraham. So what is the Gemara saying? That God said, I never imagined. Kill him? Whoever said kill him? I never said to kill him. So I'm saying, that's the Gemara's conclusion over here. What are you talking about? And when you go back to the context, these people that are offering or sacrificing their children, God says, I'm not, meaning, quite the opposite is true. The entire Torah, entire Tanakh, bless you, is a polemic against human sacrifice, against idolatry, against this kind of behavior. So if you say, God is saying, it never crossed my mind to kill him. I never said to kill him. What's also interesting here is the word velo alta. The word is alta, which is very close to alta, means to go up. Valeo sham la ola. So God, yeah, leo sham lo alta alibi. I never said to kill him. That was never on the table.
But still, he didn't tell him. He didn't say maybe to kill him. But he told him to sacrifice. So he meant something about it. Like, weird to say, it's not, I didn't think about anything like from that.
So it's a cover-up on the Gemara. I won't argue with you, by the way. The Gemara is working very hard to say, God never said such a thing. But how can the Gemara even justify making such a statement? Yeah.
If it's an emotional sacrifice, meaning if like you said before, Avram just has to get to the point where he's willing to make that sacrifice,
right?
Then to use the word sacrifice in the Pshat is fine, because it's still a sacrifice. It's not physical. He didn't actually kill him, but he was willing to go through with it.
Agreed. But this Gemara is more radical even. And that's why you're correct in pointing out. The Gemara is more radical. The Gemara is saying, I never crossed my mind to do such a thing. How can the Gemara justify itself at all? I mean, again, how can you back yourself up on this? How can you say, I never said it? So one thing is, what are the words the Torah actually used? Taken to the place that I'm going to tell you. So first of all, he never told him. That information is missing. But what else is missing? It says, Vahalehu sham la'ola. And what does the word ha'alehu literally mean? Vahalehu means to lift, to lift up. Vahalehu sham la'ola, lift him up as a lifting up. Now, it's true that later on in the Torah, we find out there's such a thing called a korban ola. But is Avram supposed to know that the Korban Olah, meaning, or does God mean the Korban Olah that we find later on, is what the intention is over here? That, I think, was what the Gemara saying. I said, take him to the mountain and lift him up. So what does lift him up mean? Did lift him up, did I ever say pull a knife on him? Did I ever say to tie him down? Did I ever tell you where the place? Meaning, what the Gemara is trying to do, and you can tell me that the Gemara is trying, is polemical, is trying to defend itself. And again, I'm not going to ignore this whole Christological aspect of it, of Christians over the ages trying to defend the crucifixion and so on, based upon this, saying, what are you talking about? God never called upon this. Maybe we'll see some more of this on a different topic later on. Yeah.
Based on the context of the generation, it seems like it would make sense that it's alluding to human sacrifice.
I'm not going to argue with you. I agree. I agree that's a very easy way of reading it. I'm just pointing out that the word kill him is not there. The word tie him is not there. The word shecht him is not there. Again, you can read and you can understand any way that you want. It's just that the actual horrific request or order happens to be missing.
But I think the test is that to see what Abraham understands from that.
So like, that's very interesting. Right, that becomes very interesting. Look, there was somebody who, based upon the Gemara that I quoted, some other things like this, said, oh, Avram failed the test. I'm not really comfortable saying that. Why? Because Jewish tradition doesn't think he failed the test. He thinks he passed the test. A matter of fact, God himself says, you passed the test. You know, now I know. And I'm going to try to come back to that as well. But I wouldn't say that. But what I would say is that the Gemara or rabbinic tradition, at least one voice in it, is trying to move as far away from the human sacrifice element as possible. We're trying to move away from the part of it that we find most disturbing. Okay. So that meaning, this is not a 21st century commentary coming to, oh, God didn't say that. This is a commentary coming, you know, from real, real long time ago, and say, no, it's not talking about sacrifice. That's not what God said. This was never on the table. Yeah.
So is it like a contradiction in terms that he ties him down when he wants to lift him up? I mean, is it that he's disobeying in order to obey, disobeying the letter of the law? Why do you say he ties him down at the same time that it's...
So lifting him up means let's go up to the mountain. When he gets there, he ties him down. And we call it Akedat Yitzchak. That instruction to tie him is missing as well. So you can say he ties him because of... it makes it easier. By the way, the Midrash, in a beautiful, beautiful statement, actually gives a voice to somebody else who is pretty silent about the whole thing, and that's Yitzchak. According to the Midrash, the tying down was Yitzchak's idea. The Midrash says, Yitzchak says to Avraham, he says, Father, he goes, the spirit is strong, but the body is weak. Right? The spirit is strong, but the body is weak. And I'm afraid that when I see the glistening of the knife, that I'm going to pull away, and therefore I will make the slaughtering invalid, and therefore tie me down in order to make sure that the shechita is done perfectly. So it's very, I mean, again, you want to be disturbed, that's even worse. It's saying that the whole idea of the Akedah was Yitzchak's idea. And I say Akedah, I'm using that in its narrower sense, that the tying itself, according to Midrash, was Yitzchak's idea and wasn't even... Avram's idea.
Like mother, like son. I mean, Sarah had to cook up her scheme and he had to do his...
Yeah.
He overstepped the bounds of what they had to do.
Yeah, so it's very, very interesting that the Midrash is going to go that far to say it's Yitzchak's idea. But why would it say that? Because the Midrash knows what I know and what we all know now. What's that? That God never said it. So if God never said it, where'd it come? Okay, it was Yitzchak's idea.
But like
excuse me?
Like the people also, like,
now that I say that, that they're people. Okay.
I'm kidding.
The...
better than say they're like a character. That's always my issue.
Okay. Now, the thing... Okay, we've already gone through a little bit of some of the Christological issues in terms of the crucifixion, resurrection, and so on. And they are here in the background on the one hand. But the other thing... And as I said, that can bring people in one direction to be somewhat disturbed. There's a whole other issue to it. And what's that? That's going to be the whole comparison, which is 100% here, between the story with Yishmael and the story of Yitzchak. Which means chapter 21 and chapter 22, one is right after the other. In chapter 21, Avram is called upon to take his son, to take him and to throw him out of the house. And he's not that happy about it, as we already discussed. God tells him to do this anyway. Is there any kind of comparison between these two? Now, if you want, you can go home, you can read through chapter 21, read through chapter 22, look at the words, look at the phrases, look at the scenes, look at the responses, and you will have no choice but to notice that there are parallels, very strong parallels going on between the two of them. They're not exact, but there's enough parallels there that they cannot be ignored. As I said in the very beginning, the question then becomes, okay, now what do you do with that? So there are those who are what we'll call very, very left-wing politically who will say, I call this Akedat Yishmael in order to create some kind of equality and take it in terms of current political discourse and say, you know, we only talk about the deaths of Jews in terms of the whole Middle Eastern problem, but what about all the deaths of the Arabs? And we ignore Akedat Yishmael and we pay too much time and attention to Akedat Yitzchak. And until we recognize that there is both an Akedat Yishmael and an Akedat Yitzchak, we can never get to a situation of peace. Now, that's all very wonderful, but what it's essentially doing is taking information which really is here and then drawing your own political conclusion. That's why I said you can take it however you want to, because there's also another conclusion over here which is also very clear, and that is that God says to Abraham, Yishmael is not your real child. When I say your real child, the reason he's not his real child is a very technical reason, and that is, maybe we'll talk about this next week, is that Hagar is not your real wife, which means she's not your real wife. This is not your real child. Your real child, and there's your son, your only son, is Yitzchak, and God says this over here as well. That, meaning, just like Perikav Bet begins, take your son, your only son, the son that you love, over here, when it says that Avram has difficulty with it, right? Source 4, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayiraha devar ma'od bein Avraham aladot b'no, vayom alakim alam, al yirah b'necha, ala nar v'almatecha, kol asher tomar alecha sarkola, ki bi Yitzchak yikra l'chazara. That who is your real child? Your real child is Yitzchak. And don't worry so much what's going to happen to him. Where, nonetheless, are the parallels that we see in both? So I tried to bold them. In Pasuk Yudalid, Vayishkem Avram Baboker. So you realize that he gets up for both of these episodes. He gets up early in the morning to get rid of one son, to get rid of the other son. What else? You have, in both stories, you have the appearance of a bush. Yes? In Pasuk Tedvav, Vatishalach Riyela Tachar Achad HaSichim. Bush is not used in the same way in both stories. Pasuk Ted Zion. She says she can't see the death of her son. And she cries. Opposite. Again, just because something is the opposite doesn't mean it's not connected. Which means over here, Avraham is wanting to pull the knife and to kill him. She can't even see him dying from natural causes, as it were, from lack of hydration. And she turns and cries. Those tears we never find in the Akedah story, other than somebody pointed out that the angels may cry. Angels cry. Who's not crying? Avram's not crying. And by the way, in fact, the same midrash that says the angels were crying, it says Avram was ecstatic and happy, which makes it all the more perhaps difficult to understand. By the way, in the Middle Ages, when Jews were often called upon during the Crusades to convert or die, and there were those who lost children, there were even some, and I don't want to talk about this more than just mentioning this, there were even those who killed their own children to avoid forced conversions, and when they did this, they read the text of the Akedah, and they said, God, you know, and they made a bracha even. God who forced, you know, Avram to kill the son, is now forced me, or at least with him an angel came to prevent it, but this is something which did happen during the Middle Ages, so the Akedah became this symbol for unfortunate, for people dying, Al-Kiddush Hashem, for people dying, you know, sanctifying the name of God. It's actually a really bad rabbinic joke that goes with that. That during the Crusades, a crusader, he approaches a Jew and said, a rabbi, and says to him, you know, either convert or die. So he says, I don't have a choice. I'm a convert. Kiddush Hashem. So he goes, you'll have to kill him. I mean, you want to kill me? You have to kill me. So the guy, you know, takes out the sword and is about to chop his head off, and he goes, wait. Before you die, I'll kiddush Hashem. There's a bracha that you can make. So he goes, okay. A blessing. So he says, say the blessing. He goes, wait. I have to wash my hands first. So he takes some water. You know, 1, 2, 2, 2, 3, 3. Washes his hands. And he says, Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, asher kiddush Hashem, v'tzav tzivanu, al kiddush Hashem. Right? That, you know, sanctifying. And the crusader's looking at him. He says, you know, I've never seen anything like this. He's just ready to die. He goes, you know what? I'm not going to kill you. And he goes, Isn't that bad? Okay. I think it's the brisker meets the crusader. I think that's what it is. So, the response of Avraham is in the Midrash one of ecstasy, but we don't see any tears. He's carrying through with it. She cannot look, and she cries. But then, Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayishma Elokim et kol hanar, Vayikra malach Elokim, and an angel calls out. What happens, what's the key line in the Akedah? An angel calls out. By the way, it's not the same angel. Here it's malach Elokim, and there it's malach Hashem. But still you have the intercession of an angel coming into the story. And then you have the blessing that follows it, Kilo Goy Godol Asimenu. And over here you have this blessing that God says to Avram that, you know, you're going to become, that Yitzhak will become a great nation. Which means it's not just that, you know, sending, you know, Yitzhak possibly being killed and Yishmael being sent away. There are many more elements in this story that parallel one another, which means the comparison between the two really is much more of a fair comparison than I think people will notice at first glance. The question again becomes, okay, there is a comparison here. Now, what do you do with this comparison? Does this mean, again, I think I've already spelled out and you all understand how this now can be used, you know, in any political way that you want to take it, and I can assure you that it has been. It's become very popular in the last 20 years or so to speak about Akedat Yishmael. I can guarantee you that in whatever newspapers you read on Shabbat, someone's going to have some kind of an article and mention something along these lines, because, as I said, it is quite popular. Let's continue. There may, however, be something else which will take us back to the previous chapter, which may also be connected. Now, this is something which we become desensitized to because it just happens too many times. Let's go to source number 3, because we haven't looked at that chapter at all. Vayisa Avraham Misham, Vayisa Misham Avraham, Arza Negev, Vayeshiv ben Kadesh ben Shur, Vayigar Bigrar. Avram travels and he ends up in this place and lives in Grar. Vayoma Avram el Sarah Ishto, Achoti. Avram says, once again, as I said, we've seen this movie already, he refers to Sarah as his sister. And Avimelech, the king of Gerar, he takes her. So I think we should make an observation that essentially all of the men, you ready for this? All of the men in Bereshit who behave poorly, they all come from the same line. They all come from the family of Ham. All come from Ham. Ham, as Rav Hirsch points out, must be hot-blooded, and that's why he's called Ham. And he imparts upon his descendants this hot-bloodedness. So therefore, one of these descendants is going to be Paro, because Mitzrayim comes from this family line. Another one of these descendants is going to be Avimelech. Avimelech from Plishtim is also going to become from this line. And Stone, by the way, comes from this line as well. We have, again, all misbehaving people come from this line. I'm not sure if we're going to get to Stone. But in Stone, you have the same, even more extreme behavior. In Stone, you have, you know, when these angels come, where they ask the men to be sent outside so they get to know them. And being this is the Bible, it means to know them in the biblical sense. And it's quite clear from the text that that's what they're intention is, which means that, that this is why Sodom gets its reputation, is that they do want to rape these men. But again, this is the same kind of bad behavior going on, which means otherwise you can say, I mean, what do you mean that she is a good-looking woman and therefore you want to take, like what's... That's not the way decent people behave. It also indicates that this really bad behavior that existed before the flood that we thought we got rid of, we didn't get rid of completely. That that some of this did survive. I mean, part of the problem is that Noah may have deserved to be saved, but did all of his children deserve to be saved? And therefore, what we have is this bad behavior survives the flood and continues, and now we keep meeting up with it along the line. So that's the background for Perek Kaf. Avram gets to this place, and he says that Sarah is in fact his sister. Pasuk Gimel. Vayavo Elokim el Avraham b'chalom halayla. And God appears to Avimelech in a dream. Vayomer lo, and he says to him, Hincha meit, you're dead. I mean, the reason why it comes out sound like this, if I'm from Brooklyn, it sounds very mafia-like. God comes and says, you're dead. Al ha'isha asher lakachta, because of this woman that you took, v'hibu ulad ba'al, and she's a married woman. V'avimelech lo karav eleha, and Avimelech did not come near, he didn't touch her. V'yomar, and he says, Adonai, God. Hagoy gam tzadik taharog? By the way, you realize what's interesting about that? He just now channeled his inner Avraham, and he's giving the same argument that Avram gave in terms of stone. Avram argues to save stone, which, by the way, is an evil place full of these evil people. Avram's arguing to save it because there may be some righteous people here. So what is Avimelech saying? He's using the same argument. And by the way, again, this is the argument that who doesn't use? That Avram doesn't use when he has an opportunity of saving Yitzchak. So he says, Are you going to kill a righteous person? Halo hu amar li achotihi. He said to me, it's my sister. Vihi gam hi amra achihu. And she said, it's my brother. Bitom livavi. What does that mean? With an innocent heart. Right? Tmimut, tam. Bitom livavi, with an innocent heart. Uvnikeyon kapai, and clean hands, asiti zot, I did this. So what's his, how is he defending himself? What did he do? There's this woman, she's good looking, he takes her home. Vayomer elav Elokim, and God said, b'chalom, again, stressing that God only speaks to Avimelech in a dream, gam anoch yadati, I know, ki betom levavcha, asiti zot. You did this with innocent heart. What doesn't he say?
Okay.
You're right. With pure hands, that he won't agree. Rashi points that out. Ve'echsoch gam anochi otcha michatoli. And therefore I prevented you from sinning. According to the Midrash, which embellishes this point, bless you, it says that that God sent a malach with a 2x4, and every time Avimelech reached over for Sarah, he smacked him upside the head with a 2x4, and soon enough Avimelech had a headache and was not in the mood. Al kain lo natatiha lingoa eleha. I would not let you touch her. But by the way, by later on in Toldot, it says, you know, Eila Toldot Avraham, Avraham et Yitzchak, Avram fathered Yitzchak. So there Rashi brings, it says that there were these quote unquote called these late Sonei Hador. You know what the late Sonei Hador are? The stand up comics of the generation, the jokers of the generation, late Sonei Hador. They would say, oh, that Avraham, you know, how can an old man have a child? So the indication was, that we're trying to say, was that it was actually when she was sequestered together with Avimelech for the night, that's when Sarah got pregnant. Because how can you have an old man like that? Of course, what information were they ignoring? That Avraham, as an old man, already had one child, who Yishmael. There is an approach that one could say is that when we saw before that Yishmael was mitzachek, he was making fun. What was he making fun of? He was telling over these same jokes and saying, you really think that Avram fathered Yitzchak? It must be, why? Because he had an agenda in this. Namely, he didn't want Yitzchak to be the one to inherit Avram's wealth. So he tried to imply that Yitzchak was not really Avram's son, and therefore he would get no inheritance. And what's God's response? God's response to Avram is no. Yitzchak is the one who's going to inherit you. So therefore the mitzachek over there may be connected to what Rashi mentions as the late Sonei Hador. Of course, you know, that's the good thing about stand-up, is as long as it's funny, you laugh, but you don't start thinking all the way through. What I mean, I don't want to make a value judgment over here, but Avram had a child not that long ago. Sarah is a 90-year-old woman and didn't have any children. So over here, it sounds like it's a miraculous birth. And the more, you know, interesting part is that Sarah gives birth, not that Avram, who already had a child, would have a child. But nonetheless, that's what stand-ups do. If you can make fun of something, you go ahead and make fun of it. So over here, you notice the Torah is stressing. He didn't touch her. God would not let her touch her. Meaning, here we have an insider's report about what happened that night. And what's the answer? What happened? Absolutely nothing. God says, that's why I didn't let you touch her. Pasuk Zayin. Va'ata. Now, Hashev Eshet Ha'ish Ki Navihu. Return this married woman, for he is a prophet. Va'yitpalel ba'adcha v'chaya. And let him pray for you, and then you're going to live. By the way, this is actually mentioned in the Mishnah, and it's mentioned in the Halacha, that when you wrong somebody, that you need to make up with them. So one of the suggestions is to the point that they're actually willing to pray for you. Which means that you really apologize in a very, very sincere fashion. And over here, God says, return her. And he's a prophet, let him pray for you. But if you don't, ve'en chameshiv, and if you don't do this, da kimot tamut ata akol asherlach, you and everything you own will die. Okay, by the way, you notice the theme now? Now, Avimelech gets up early in the morning, so you also see how this may be connected. And he calls all of his servants, and he tells them everything that transpired, and the men were, for obvious reasons, quite frightened. And Avimelech calls Avram. Now, I want you to pay attention. All of my English studies majors and professors and so on, you're going to help me now. Vayomer, vayomer lo. And he said to him, Ma asita lanu, umechatata lach, kiveta laiva malchichata gdola, ma asima shaloya su asita mati. He said to him, what did you do to us, and what did we ever do to you, that you brought upon my king, my kingdom, a terrible sin, things which aren't done you've done to me. My question is, what tone of voice does he use? Is this a serious question or is this a rhetorical question? By the way, if I haven't said this yet, I'll say it. I'm going to say it again and say it again. The most difficult part of biblical interpretation is the most basic, and that is listening to the tone of voice being used. When you determine the tone of voice, now you can understand the conversation. If you don't understand the tone of voice, then the conversation eludes you. So what tone of voice does he use over here? Is there sincerity, or is this a rhetorical question? How do you know? I agree. How do you know?
Because they got the proof of the actual text, why it's rhetorical.
Yes, yes. Because he asks him a rhetorical question. Me'asita lanu, what did you do to him? He knows what he did. What did he do? He's okay.
He answers it.
He knows what he did. What, excuse me, say it again.
He answers it.
Which part does he answer? He doesn't answer this. What did you do? Me'asita lanu. What did you do to us? Completely rhetorical. Why? Because he knows what he did to him. He's not expecting an answer. What is he say next? Umachata tilach. What did I do to you? Kiaveta alaiva amalticha tagdula. You poured upon me and my kingdom great sins. Ma'asim asher lo yasosi tamidim. You did things which simply aren't done. What did he do which was so bad? What did Avram do which is so bad? So let me ask you a different question. Was Avimelech a moral person? Okay, don't answer that. Did Avimelech think he was a moral person? Is there moral outrage in Avimelech's part right here?
Yes.
Okay, so if there's moral outrage, then he must have deluded himself into thinking he's a moral person. Okay, what does his morality say to him? What is his sense of morality? What would he never do? Avimelech is moral because he would never sleep with a married woman. What would he do if there was a married woman he wanted to sleep with? Kill the husband. Why? Because he's moral. Now, the only reason this is amusing is because we live in a time and place that a lot of people would sleep with married women, but you don't go around killing people because we're moral, right? So here, what we're meeting is somebody who has moral outrage because he almost causes him to do something which is terrible. I mean, there's a stigma against this. This is absolutely unacceptable to sleep with somebody who's married, but Avimelech would not think twice, and he would kill Avram if he knew. So what does he say to him? He goes, what did you do to me? How can you do this? You almost brought a terrible sin upon me. Things that aren't done, you've done to me. How do I know that it's rhetorical, aside from everything that was just now rhetorical? Pasuk Yud. Vayomer Avimelech al Avraham. What's strange about that? And Avimelech said to Avram. Well, why is that strange? Because he's in the middle of speaking still. If he's in the middle of speaking, Avimelech is speaking. So why does it say again, and Avimelech said to Avram? How would you explain that again? My literature majors, you have to help me now. Why would it say this? What does this indicate? That he just now changed his tone of voice. It's a new conversation now because the tone just now shifted. Till now, he was being rhetorical. Now, he asks a sincere question. What's the sincere question that he asks? Vayomer, and he says, Vayomer Avimelech Avram, Ma ra'ita ki asita devar hazeh. What does it mean, ma ra'ita? What did you see? How would you say that in English today? What was your... By the way, in Hebrew you say, ma hashkafa shakha. Hashkafa, I'm saying. What were you thinking? What's your outlook? What's your philosophy? Ma ra'ita ki asita devar hazeh. What in the world were you thinking that you did something like this? Is that a sincere question, or is that also rhetorical?
That's sincere.
Now you notice why he speaks twice. One time, yes? Is this very clear what I'm saying right now? One time he's speaking because it's a rhetorical conversation, or not even dialogue, monologue. Then he shifts from his rhetorical monologue into a sincere question, and that's why he reintroduces that Avimelech speaks. Avimelech says, what were you thinking? That Avram answers. Vayomer Avraham, Avram says, Ki amarti, I said to myself, Rak ein yirat elokim b'makom hazeh. There's no fear of God in this place. V'harguni al dvar ishti. And I would be killed because of my wife. By the way, Avimelech accepts that. Yeah, that's a valid point. Is there anything in Avram's response here which may be unfair? Yeah. He could have, he used too many words. And by using too many words, he ends up preaching. What could he have said? He could have said, I was afraid you're going to kill me. It's not what he says. What does he say? Ein yirat elokim b'makom hazeh. What does that mean? There's no fear of God in this place. Okay, what exactly is fear of God? Fear of God means that your morality is based upon what God says. If God says something, it's good. If it's good. If God says something, it's bad, it's bad. Which means you have your own moral system. What's your own moral system, Avimelech? Your moral system is you never sleep with a married woman, you kill the husband. Your morality is not based upon God. What's God's morality? God's morality is ultimate morality. What's God's ultimate morality? What God says is right, and what God says you do. Do you notice that Avram is preaching to Avimelech right here? And what happens when you preach to people? That's the meaning. I would be very tempted to say that when the Akedah starts and it says, and after these things, God tested Avraham, the first thing I want you to notice, when we go back now to Perikav Bet, V'yacharim d'rim ha'ela Elokim nisat Avraham. What is Elokim? God's strictness. God acting as a judge. Tests Avraham. But the testing may actually have this little background that we now just now noticed. When the Akedah ends, at which point does it come to an end? The angel speaks out and comes and says from heaven, but what did the angel say? Let's go back and take a look. Let's go back to Pasuk Dalet, source number 5, Perek Kafet, Pasuk Dalet. And let's just take it through now. Vayom HaShlishi, on the third day, Vayisa Avram Adina Vayarta Makom Mirachok. He sees the place from afar. So we have two possibilities here. What are two possibilities? Either he's got, received more information, or suddenly his intuition is that he's found the right place. Vayom Avram Ma'arav Shvu Lechem Po HaMachamor Vaniva Nar Nechad Ko V'Nishtachavav V'Nashuv Aleichem. We will go up, serve God, we will come back. So Avram does also have some kind of intuition, or he's lying, that they're both going to come back. He takes the wood and he places it on Yitzchak, and that's where we have Yitzchak bearing his own cross, as it were. He takes the fire, the knife, and they proceed. He says to his father, by the way, this is the only time in the Torah that Avram and Yitzchak speak to one another. This is the only conversation, so you have to listen very carefully. Vayomer Yitzchak el Avraham Aviv. And Yitzchak says to Avram his father. Vayomer, he says, Avi, father. Vayomer, hineni b'ni. Here I am, my son. By the way, at this point, do you hear any love? Do you feel love in that, in this, or no? I absolutely do. Father, son, yeah. There's something very warm, very tender about this. Vayomer Avi, vayomer hineni b'ni. Here I am, my son. Yitzchak says, you have the fire, you have the wood, where is the sel le'ola? So here you clearly see that Yitzchak understands there is a burnt offering to be made. What does he say? Vayomar Avraham, your Eloah se, Vayomar Avraham, and he says, Elokim, God, your Eloah se le'ola b'ni, he will show the offering. V'yachushneim yachtav, and they walk together. By the way, how did it start? It started at the end of Pasuk Vav, V'yichlu Shneim Yachtov. They both go together. They have this one little conversation, V'yichlu Shneim Yachtov. They go together.
You said before that only the Torah says about the Olah. They don't know about that yet, right?
And here it's used. Correct. Here it's used.
They have like a Mustag of Sele Olah.
Here we see it, right? Here we see it. I'm saying when God said it, there was no earlier mentioning of an Olah, and here we see it's clearly the way they understand it. Agreed. They see the place. Even Shemavram at the Mizbeach, he builds the altar. Vayarochet Eitzim, he puts the wood. Vayakod it Yitzchak Beno, and he ties him down. Vayasim Atol Mizbeach Mimal Eitzim, and he places him down on the Mizbeach, on top of the wood. Vayishlach Avram et Yado, and he lifts up his hand. Vayikachet Machelet, he takes the sword, the knife. Vayishchodet Beno, in order to do the shechita. Vayikrai Lav Malach Hashem in Hashemayim. Vayomar Avraham Vayomar Hineni. Right, and that's also the parallel that we had with Yishmael, the Malach calling out. Vayomer al tishlach yadcha el anar, va'al tasal l'mu'uma. Don't stretch out your arm to the child. Don't do anything. Ki ata yadati, for now I know, ki arei Elokim ata. Now I know that you fear God. Now you notice the same phrase over here, Yirat Elokim. So when I said before, when Avraham preaches to Avimelech and says, "Ein mer, ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh," there's no fear of God. What is fear of God? Objective morality based upon what God says. So God turns to Avraham and says, okay, morality is based on what God says. Go take your son and offer him up as an offering. So now Avraham's stuck. Because if he says anything, now he's going against what he has been preaching. What's he preaching? What God says is moral. So at this point, Avraham is leveraged to the point that he can't respond. So therefore, as I said, aside from everything else I said, and I do believe that there's a sense that somehow it's going to work out, although, again, I'll say that the way it could have worked out is to kill him, and resurrection, and so on, Tchiyat HaMetim. I mean, we actually believe in Tchiyat HaMetim. We say this in our prayers. But over here, I think that we have another insight, that when it didn't begin, Ve'elokim nisat Avraham. It's Vayachor d'Ma'ele, Elokim nisat Avraham. Which means the starting point of the Akedah is Elokim Midat Hadin, God saying, okay, let's see, if you're willing to serve God. Look, the other point is that Avraham had always been a man who serves God through what we call Chesed. Meaning, that's the beginning of the parasha. These three men come, and Avraham's running around to help them, to serve them, and certainly if it came right after the circumcision, then that really embellishes it even more, how difficult he doesn't feel, but nonetheless, he takes in his guests. We know that He's somebody who has this incredible sense of kindness. So if the test of the Akedah would have been, okay, I'm going to send 50 guests Friday night to Avram's house, we all know that wouldn't have been a test for him. That's something which would have energized, would have excited Avram. But the thing that makes this into a test is that it goes against the way that he serves God. And that's why it's Elohim, it's Midatadin. But what happens once he's willing to serve God that way? So now God, and by the way, it's significant, it's Malach Hashem, right? Midataracham Yudkevavke coming and said, Atayatat, now I know, Ki Yarei Elohim Ata, that not only do you excel in serving God in terms of compassion, you also have now showed or displayed that you can serve God through what we would call Yirat Hashem as well, Yirat Elohim as well. And ultimately, the last point for today, when it says that God tests Avraham, it's absurd to believe that God doesn't know how Avraham's going to respond. The purpose of the test is not, you know, like a professor in college has to test the students because they may not know how the students are going to do. God knows it, which means the test is not for Avraham. Sorry, it's not for God. The test is for Avraham. Avraham needs to develop this other side of him that perhaps he had not developed until this point. But as I said, the most intriguing, not the most intriguing, an intriguing aspect of this is those introductory words. So what did we see today? That we've looked at various earlier parts of this parsha, and we've seen things which I think give us more information. Is it the whole comparison and contrast with Ishmael? That's very intriguing. Is it the whole comparison when Avraham himself argues in terms of saving stone? I think that there's some intrigue in that as well. Is it Avraham's interaction with Avimelech? I think that there's something intriguing there as well. Is it perhaps a combination of all of these things? So I think that maybe that's what it means. After all of these things, we're now able to understand the Akedah that much better. Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
I'm like, oh, like,